It's challenging, but we keep trying and do our best because of the limited of the gasoline.
Slow progress is being made amid Indonesia's devastation. It's Monday, October 15th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Rohingyas more anxious in India. Taiwan works to keep a spiritual ally. Calls to evacuate an Australian asylum camp. Growing premature babies and building big cities with big data. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The World Health Organization says progress is being made to help the more than 87,000 people displaced by the 7.7 magnitude earthquake, aftershocks, tsunami, and subsequent liquefaction and landslides that has hit Indonesia almost 2 weeks ago. More than 2,000 deaths resulted from the disasters, with about 11,000 reported injuries and nearly 700 people still missing. Indonesia's military has delivered more supplies by cargo aircraft as more than two dozen countries and international organizations, including the United States, gear up to provide funding, personnel, and humanitarian aid. One of those groups already on the ground is the U.S.-based private humanitarian development and advocacy organization World Vision, which has an office in the hard-hit port city of Palu. Priscilla Christian is a spokeswoman based in Jakarta who spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about what World Vision is doing.
We built a public kitchen near our office area, and also we distribute the family kit, consists of the blanket, the tarpaulin, the towel, and also the hygiene kit to the affected community and the children.
How difficult is it getting teams into the affected area?
It's challenging, but we keep trying and do our best because of the limited of the gasoline, and also the road were blocked and collapsed. And also now it's coming more on the security issue. Since the people are coming and make the street crowded, they're looking for a help. They're asking for a support from the people who come to distribute the kids, they are coming and asking for a further support. That's why the looting happened, and that's why we need to coordinate further with the local police, with the National Disaster Agency, when we do the distribution program.
What kind of supplies are you able to provide?
We supply the food for the children, but it's still near our office area. And also we supply with the tarpaulin, with the blanket, with the towel, and all of the equipment to make them survive in the temporary shelter while the aftershock is still happening until yesterday.
Are there airports or ports available that you can use, or do you have to travel over land to get there?
Before this earthquake happened, actually we have a program, the development program in Palu. That's why some of the staff is already there. But when the additional team come to the field, to the Palu, we need to take a travel by plane 2 hours and then fly again 2 hours and then take the road trip around 12 hours. And now, actually, I will go there to Palu, and I'm still looking for a way to reach Palu. It takes a time to fly, and also the availability of the airplane is very, very limited.
Priscilla Christen said the World Vision staff of 12 is coordinating with local agencies to provide supplies, including food, at designated locations with an emphasis on meeting the needs of the region's children and infants. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. U.S. Security Advisor Bolton vows tougher approach to China. Philippines stays in Rights Council despite deadly drug crackdown. Cambodia to again search for U.S. Vietnam War dead. Sprint legend Usain Bolt has first goals in football bid. Vietnam wants to go Hollywood. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. In India, the first ever deportation of Rohingyas to Myanmar has raised the specter of more repatriations among the 40,000 Rohingyas living in the country as the Hindu nationalist government takes a tougher stand on illegal immigrants. Anjana Pasricha visited refugee camps in northern Haryana state, where Rohingyas who fled persecution and violence in Myanmar say they fear for their safety if sent back.
The Rohingyas in this refugee camp live in cramped shelters, share one water pipe, and have only a makeshift school for their children. But they are willing to cope with the squalor. This camp in Haryana's Mewat district has been a safe shelter after the constant fear they faced in their homeland.
Nobody harasses us in India. If we work, we can fend for our food. There's no problem.
But the 45 families that have lived here for 6 years worry how long they can continue to call this home. The settlement's informal head, Ali Zohar, fears the deportation of 7 Rohingyas in India's northeast has cleared the way for more to be sent back.
My life has been ruined. But what do I do about the future of my children? Will they have to return back? My mind is tired thinking.
Residents in these camps hope that the cards given out by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees will protect them from a second displacement. The 7 men deported did not have UN cards. That is why Sultan Amin always keeps the card, his most prized possession, locked away. He says his brothers and mother in Myanmar tell him they still face harassment.
I am prepared to return to my country, but it is very difficult to save your life. I escaped here to save myself. How can I go back to be killed?
India, however, says it does not recognize the UN cards and calls all Rohingyas illegal immigrants who will be sent back. The government has called them a security threat. Observers link the tougher stand on the Muslim Rohingyas by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP government to general elections scheduled in 2019.
I have a sense that the Rohingya issue has again come up tops because elections are around the corner. Certainly, if the discourse can be polarized on Hindu-Muslim lines, it's advantage BJP.
The refugees, many of whom came to India from Bangladesh, say all they want is a patch of land where they can be safe and eke out a living.
All my relatives, family there have been killed. When our country is safe like India and Bangladesh, we will go back.
Such voices are supported by the United Nations Refugee Agency, which has criticized the deportation of the 7 Rohingyas and says refugees should not be sent back to countries where they fear persecution. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Haryana, India.
Happening now in Asia, the Philippines has been elected to the UN Human Rights Council, boosting President Rodrigo Duterte's reputation after 2 years of criticism of hitman-style killings in his country's crackdown on illegal drugs. Rights groups oppose the country's bid, saying it has no business joining the council. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us as we both start out a brand new week on VOA Asia. The Taiwanese Vice President Chen Qianzhen is visiting the Vatican. He attended the canonization of Pope John Paul VI and having a private audience with Pope Francis. The meeting comes following last month's provisional and historic agreement between the Holy See and China in the appointment of bishops, a stumbling block to normalizing relations. The Vatican represents Taiwan's last European diplomatic foothold as Beijing continues to whittle down the number of nations that maintain official ties with Taipei. Retired Hong Kong University professor Joseph Cheng tells VOA's Victor Beatty, while Taiwan would like to maintain diplomatic ties with the Vatican, its survival is not dependent on keeping official links with a handful of countries in Africa, Latin America, and Oceania.
Taiwan counts on maintaining prosperous trade relations with the developed countries in the world, and it seems to be rather successful in doing that. There is, of course, a prestige reason namely that the Vatican is the only European country maintaining diplomatic relations with Taiwan, and Taiwan believes that it has a certain moral appeal to the Vatican, since there are many Catholics in Taiwan, and certainly the Tsai Ing-wen administration would appeal to the Vatican, stating Taiwan Catholic faithful's strong dedication to the Catholic Church. However, it seems that diplomatic relations between the Vatican and China does not very much depend on considerations of the concerns of Taiwan. It has much to do with the resolution of the outstanding issues between Beijing and the Vatican, and the agreement on the appointment of bishops seems to have removed a very significant obstacle to the establishment of diplomatic relations.
Mr. Chun has indicated that the Taiwan government hopes that the Vatican will not abandon Taiwan in deference to China.
The Tsai Ing-wen administration and the vice president certainly would like to be seen to be working hard on maintaining diplomatic relations with the Vatican, especially in view of the coming important local elections to be held next month. So if the vice president manages at least to delay the decision, it will at least contribute to the election campaign next month. Although I think the Tsai Ing-wen administration also understands that if Beijing and the Vatican can agree on the appointment of bishops and other outstanding issues, there is not much that Taipei can do. Because after all, Vatican correctly estimates that it can maintain still very strong relations with the Catholic faithful in Taiwan, even in the absence of diplomatic relations.
The Taiwan ambassador to the Vatican, Matthew Lee, in remarks in Rome marking Taiwan's National Day last week, said Communist China remains committed to making the Taiwan people irrelevant. He said with the assistance of global partners standing up to the rising autocratic authoritarian power of Beijing, Taiwan will persist, persevere, and prevail. Joseph Cheng said Taiwan does not feel diplomatically isolated, even as more countries cut ties in favor of official links to Beijing. He said Taipei continues to enjoy and benefit from semi-official status with the European Union, the United States, Japan, and other major developed nations. Coming up, a call for the evacuation of an asylum detention center. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton has vowed to further intensify the Trump administration's tough approach to China, saying Beijing's behavior needs to be adjusted in the trade area, in the international, military, and political areas. Bolton said they've never seen an American president this tough before. It's easy to visit VOA Asia Facebook for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a medical charity is calling for the immediate evacuation of all refugees and asylum seekers from Nauru and an end to Australia's controversial offshore detention policy. Staff from Médecins Sans Frontières, also known as Doctors Without Borders, were forced to leave the Pacific Island last week, almost a year after the organization began providing mental and health services to migrants in an Australian-sponsored camp. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Nauru's government says it can meet the mental health needs of residents as well as refugees and asylum seekers detained in an Australian-run immigration facility. The camp has been used to hold unauthorised migrants caught trying to reach Australia by boat. On Friday, the Nauru government told Médecins Sans Frontières staff that they had to leave the island. In response, MSF said conditions on the tiny Pacific Republic were beyond desperate. The medical charity says it's concerned for the more than 100 asylum seekers and refugee children on Nauru, citing fears about post-traumatic stress, attempted suicide and self-harm. Paul McFunn is Executive Director at MSF Australia.
We make no mistake, MSF is extremely concerned for the ongoing mental health of all our patients remaining on the island, including asylum seekers and refugees, who remain in a complete state of hopelessness and despair. MSF calls for the immediate evacuation of all asylum seekers and refugees. MSF calls for an end to the Australian policy of indefinite offshore detention.
Nauru is one of two locations in the South Pacific used by Australia to process asylum seekers. The other on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea closed last October after local judges ruled it unconstitutional because of the poor conditions at the camp. More than 200 detainees are held in Nauru. Under strict border control measures, they won't be allowed to ever resettle in Australia, even if found to be genuine refugees. Australia says it has no intention of closing the facility, despite repeated condemnation from rights groups. Canberra argues that offshore processing is a powerful deterrent for migrants risking their lives at sea, often trying to make the journey on rickety fishing boats from Indonesia. Peter Dutton is Australia's Home Affairs Minister.
I've been very clear before, if I could bring all of those people to Australia tomorrow, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But if I did that, I'd restart boats. And then you'll be asking me about the children who are drowning at sea.
The flow of migrant boats arriving in Australia's territorial waters has stopped. Navy vessels have been ordered to either tow or turn unauthorised boats away. Australia's acceptance of refugees is relatively small compared to other wealthy countries. In 2016, Australia resettled 27,626 people from overseas. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. Cambodia has agreed to resume a search effort with the United States for the remains of Americans killed in the Vietnam War. Cambodia suspended the program a year ago as tension rose between the two countries when Washington stopped issuing some visas after Cambodia refused to accept deported criminals. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, no one knows why some babies are born prematurely, but some of the smallest premature babies weigh under 1,500 grams. These tiny babies, or micro-preemies, cannot afford to lose any weight. At Children's National Medical Center here in Washington, a team of specialists has come up with a plan to give these babies the best chance to thrive. We have more from VOA's Carol Pearson in this report written by Jun So.
When JC was born, he weighed just a little more than 736 grams. But look at him now. He no longer looks like the micro-preemie he once was.
I was so scared to touch him at first, and he was so small, and I couldn't even change a diaper. I was so nervous and anxious. He just looked so frail, but the nurses were very supportive and encouraging.
JC was born at just 24 weeks. Full-term babies are born between 39 and 40 weeks.
We're going to do an EKG this morning because of the PVCs.
A team of specialists at the NICU, the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, wanted to see if they could help JC and other very small preterm babies boost their weight and improve their chances to thrive.
Preemies in particular have a high incidence of malnutrition as well as poor development.
Put you back in your belly, okay?
These babies have so little body fat, they can't afford to waste energy. Some are in blanketed incubators to encourage sleep. The team focused on what and when the babies ate.
We noticed that a lot of our practitioners and the way that they were providing feedings for our very low birth weight babies, so those are babies that were born 1,500 grams or less. They're being fed all kinds of different varying ways.
Good job. Pump it, Mom. It's impressive.
They wanted to make sure all babies were getting the same care, to boost calories and improve their nutrition. Wherever possible, the team emphasized mother's milk.
That is what's best for the premature babies. They tolerate it better, has great antibodies.
We know that mother's milk has growth factors in it that can't be replaced with any other substance.
I just kind of separate it to make sure that I have all of the batch numbers.
The team standardized nutrition practices. They can include fortified donor breast milk for babies whose mothers can't provide their own, or fortified mother's milk, or formula, depending on each baby's needs.
I'm very pleased. We have been able to put protocols in place so that there's a standardization of care for these babies and the feeding aspect. We've also increased the amount of mother's own milk we've been providing for the babies, which is great.
We were able to improve their weight by 30%.
The team isn't done yet. They want to tweak the nutrition practices to see if they can improve their results. Once they're finished, they'll publish the results so other micropreemies can benefit too. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The recent massive breach of Facebook and the exposure of the information of an estimated 50 million users has highlighted one of the problems with all the data that we're putting out into the world. VOA's Kevin Enix reports that city planners share those concerns, but they're also looking at how big data might be a big boost in helping their own cities develop.
This is Canary Wharf in London. Between closed-circuit TV cameras and cell phones, there's a treasure trove of information flowing around that city planners would love to get their hands on. Fabio Duarte from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology can see why, but he also recognizes the privacy concerns.
So who is collecting this data and what this data is used for? This is a very important question. But on the other hand, we from our university, what we can do is to make sense of this data and to see which benefits we can have from this data and bring these achievements back to the city.
But Duarte thinks we're entering an era when big data isn't just coming from people. City planners can get all kinds of unique information from Google Street View, for instance, and Tripedia, what MIT developed to track greenery.
In Tripedia, we are collecting the data that Google Street Views gives us. So Google Street Cars, they are collecting images from more than 400 cities around the world. And we thought, but what could we do with this data beyond simply seeing where I live?
This is all anonymous data, as Duarte calls it, but it can be incredibly valuable.
Now we can compare dozens of cities around the world and see, look, based on computer vision techniques, I can see what is behind these Google Street View images in terms of a tree canopy, for instance. And then we can not only compare cities, but also inform urban planners to see, this area of the cities require more trees, or that area is underprivileged in terms of tree canopy.
And as our world becomes increasingly wired, Duarte expects the amount of data coming from anonymous sources will increase exponentially, which should ease privacy concerns.
Very soon, it's not people talking to people that we'll be tracking, but things talking to things. This is what we call the Internet of Things. So street lights talking to cars, to traffic lights, and to sidewalks. And then this data is anonymous. And this is the data that will actually make our cities better.
The information could help mitigate problems like people jams at subway stations and usher in a golden age of city planning. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online in several different places. Lots of ways to get our program, including iTunes and SoundCloud. We, of course, stream our program every day on voanews.com. That's our website. And VOA Asia Facebook, where we encourage you to visit each and every day. Lots of great stories and features to see and share all the time. You can also hear us on the radio. Many great radio stations around Asia, including PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today. We always extend our thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We wish you a great day ahead.